Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Big Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
I'm so upset you didn't say Big Brian. Big Brian. Now, I don't know about you, Brian. Brian. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But in movie award terms, are we the Oscars blindside? Like, they never see us coming, then we knock them down. Is that how that works?
I think Rotten Tomatoes was also a blindside for the Oscars on this one.
I think so. I think we're going to get much deeper into sportball analogies here as we go in our conversation about 2009 Best Picture nominee, The Blind Side, directed by John Lee Hancock. Here's the trailer.
I'm not cutting. I'm just asking. Let me tell you something, all right? We have been sitting around here for over an hour, and when I look around, all I see are people shooting the bull and drinking coffee.
How can I help you?
Oh, he was first.
No, you go ahead. I think I want to hear this.
Me too.
You're right.
Excuse me? You're right? How'd those words taste coming out of your mouth?
Like vinegar.
Who is that, SJ?
Big Mike. He goes to high school here.
What is he wearing? It's below freezing.
Do you have any place to stay tonight? Don't you dare lie to me.
Was this a bad idea?
What's the big deal? It's just for one night. It is just for one night, right, Leanne?
Tell me just one thing I should know about you.
I don't like to be called Big Mike.
Leanne, is this another one of your charities?
I need to find out more about his past.
He's been enrolled in 7 different institutions. His grade point average begins with 0.
He needs to do better in school.
I'd love to work with him.
This is mine?
Yes, sir.
Never had one before.
What, a room to yourself?
A bed.
Michael's grades have improved enough that he can go out for spring football.
How's he doing?
I haven't quite gotten the hang of it yet.
It's all real nice what you're doing, but don't be surprised if one day you wake up and he gone.
I heard you got your new mama now.
She's fine, too.
Michael was here.
Tell him to sleep with one eye open.
You threaten my son. You threaten me.
Sandra Bullock.
We're in the middle of practice, Leanne.
And thank me later.
His team is your family, Michael. You have to protect him. Tony here is your quarterback. You protect his blind side. When you look at him, you think of me.
Yes, ma'am.
SJ, you're going to want to get this.
Mike's the best left tackle I've seen in years. Better off somehow,
someday. You're changing that boy's life.
No, he's changing mine.
The Blind Side.
I said you could thank me later. It's later, Bert.
I'm glad that last line is in it. There's many
cliches,
one-liners that are very predictable. I did laugh when she said the last one though during the movie. Like, you said you could thank me later.
Yeah,
it's later, Bert. That was good. Sandra Bullock is like kind of perfect for this movie. She's done a lot of movies like it where she's like funny, she's super sassy, you know, she's kind of like, you know, I'm just gonna go in and charm and charisma my way through whatever problem happens. And it's fun to watch that happen. It kind of reminds me of watching Erin Brockovich. You know, I think I saw some parallels to that.
Yeah, a lot of comps between those two.
Yeah.
But does being a straight shooter make you a good football coach? Because she solves football
in
one conversation.
Absolutely.
She really does solve everything, but he doesn't know how to play football. He doesn't even know what his job is.
Yeah.
And she gives him one, you know, motivational speech and it turns the whole thing around. He's a star.
It's a miracle.
I don't know. Maybe she had to talk to our softball teams back in the day and turn us around.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll get into this, but Sandra Bullock's performance was widely praised. She won the Academy Award for Best Actress. She also won Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Motion Picture Drama. Is this a drama or a comedy?
It's a drama.
How close is it? 50-50? Is it 70-30 drama, maybe? 60-40 drama?
I think it's mostly
a drama. Right.
It's just that Sandra Bullock is kind of fun to watch, which makes you chuckle sometimes.
There's a lot of like borderline silliness to the movie, though. I mean, it's very much, there's some sort of campy humor to it throughout that was kind of interesting for being in the drama category. She also won Screen Actors Guild for Best Actress. That's a pretty good sweep right there. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at the full list yet of who else was nominated and what other categories there were, but or who else was in there. Now, one thing she was nominated for but didn't win, sadly, was the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards Favorite Actress. Mm-hmm. Nominated, didn't win.
Who won?
I don't know.
Oh, we have to know that.
My research stopped short. Yeah. It was made for $29 million, and it took in $309.
That's a haul.
That is a haul. The Blind Side has become the highest grossing football movie sports drama all time.
Domestically. Sports drama general.
$309
Would that include Rocky?
I don't know.
That's a sports drama.
Unadjusted for ticket inflation.
I don't know.
So that means you get more, like these were $10 tickets at the time, $9 tickets. They're probably like 10 cents for Rocky, right?
I've got to see this criteria because if we're talking about just football movies, okay, you know, Remember the Titans, Any Given Sunday. These aren't movies that I think made that kind of money.
Any
but
of those movies, any sport movies, you're talking 100 to 150, you'd think that's a good sports movie haul.
This is
309.
I feel like probably Rocky IV. Adjusted for
Rocky
inflation.
Five, maybe?
Maybe.
Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 66.
Okay.
Pretty mixed reviews. I mean, 2/3 gave it a thumbs up, but Metacritic, which is a little more, you know, accurate to as far as how highly people rated it, it was only a 53 on Metacritic. But audiences, can you guess what audiences gave it on CinemaScore? Scale of A
probably
to F.
Probably really high. Crowd pleaser, 85.
A plus.
We're not in percentages. Okay.
A plus. 99%. Let's say.
All right.
Coming up on the show, we'll do some questions, talk trivia, keep it or kick it, and then we'll be done.
So is the blonde son, SJ, the most insufferable child performance that you've ever seen, or is it just in the top five for you? Just curious.
You want my expert analysis?
Yeah.
My film critic? You want me to put on my film critic hat here?
I really do, yeah.
Again, it's sort of like a caricature, not a character. He's just kind of, he's the little loudmouth, you know, brother who is 100% on board with everything positive. He gets into a car crash and he's like, thumbs up, haha, making jokes about my blood on my shirt. And he's talking tough to Nick Saban and all these other big football coaches. Like
he's leading negotiations.
He's flawless. He's a cartoon character. He's flawless, just like his sister and his mother and his father. But I did like one last moment when he's going out on the field in the closing credits. You probably immediately turned it off after.
When the credits hit, I'm out. Yeah.
But there's a little film reel of the real Michael Oher.
Oh, no, I did see that.
Yeah, you got to watch those.
Yeah, I mean, stuck around for that. Yes,
even
yes.
you mm-hmm. would watch that post-credit scene.
But that was a in-credit scene. If it was post, if I have to wait through the black
screen,
then
no. The kid in the fictionalized version of him walking out on the field where he jumps up, he kicks his legs up behind him, sticks his hand in the air, and he has like that. It's like a Snoopy freeze frame.
Yeah.
I kind of liked that.
Yeah, I mean, that would be an exciting moment if you're a kid, right?
It would.
But as far as performances
and
go.
And SJ got everything he wanted.
This is just by far, this is kind of what I think about when I think about child performances that I don't like.
Yeah.
This one encapsulates all of it.
Yeah.
Just being overly precocious, leading negotiations. The kid's like 8 years old, leading negotiations with these college coaches.
Well, this is based on a true story, though.
So you think that he led those negotiations
Must
in
have.
Real life? Yeah. maybe he did. But the exaggerated mannerisms also.
Yeah.
I get that none of it is supposed to be real, but the thing about that kind of performance is it's sort of relying on winning me over by the cuteness.
Yeah.
And I 100% was not. Mm-hmm. So like every moment that he was on screen, I liked this movie less. And then he left and I kind of breathed a sigh of relief every time.
So sad. So there's also a, like when he's doing the montage, the training montage, which is in every sports movie.
And he led the training montage.
Every sports
also.
Movie.
Yep.
But he's so lovable that him and they found the smallest little white kid to be next to the biggest black teenager actor they could find, basically. So they have the ultimate, you know, in contrast, but like, you know, he's got the whistle, he's got the clipboard, he's doing push up, he's doing like, you know, dumbbell raises or barbell raises with him as with the kid. So, you know, they threw in every possible training cliche as well.
Yes. Well, I'm glad that we got that out of the way, because I really, that was just, I knew it had to be the first thing we talked about, or else I was just going to be stewing on it all episode. So now I can rest easy.
Thank you. So second, my question is piggybacking off the Aaron Brockovich idea.
Not off of my kid question.
No, I'm just ignoring that one. So okay. Julia Roberts was offered this role. You could easily see her in this role. It's like the same kind of character, I think, that Julia Roberts would do well in. But both of them were kind of concerned about playing such a devout Christian. Sandra Bullock did as well. She was uncomfortable with it at first. And I'm just wondering, how is that even possible? Is Christianity so like anathema to Hollywood that it's more comfortable for like Julia Roberts to play a prostitute in Pretty Woman than it is to play a devout Christian mom? Why, how is that so bad? I don't get it.
I really don't understand it either. The first movie I thought of when you were talking about this was Doubt. And
I thought of
Doubt
too.
You have Meryl Streep playing a very devout nun. Yep. You have Philip Seymour Hoffman playing a priest. But those characters are wrestling with
it's
their
because there's
religion.
Some real drama about faith that is so central to like so many human experiences throughout history that it feels very genuine and true. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because in this one, the Christianity is kind of also cartoonish. I mean, the football coach is like, we have to do our Christian duty and let him in. Everybody knows that he's being, you know, totally fake about it. And, you know, I don't know, they talk about like, you know, they bring up God a few times in the movie, but it really has nothing to do with the story, it seems like.
Yeah.
It's just like a shorthand for this person is willing to help a homeless person. So, you know, they have a Christian label on them, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it just seems like, I don't know, that seems kind of sad to me. It's Christianity, religion.
Where did you hear it? From what source?
It was in the Wikipedia article, but both Julia Roberts and Sandra Bullock said that they were concerned about that part of the
yeah,
part.
Yeah, I kind of wonder how offhanded that remark was, or if they really did wrestle with it, because
regardless,
the whole point of an actor is to play people that they're not,
like,
right?
Anybody would be like a killer, whoever.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, a Christian, maybe that's going a little too far. So I've always felt like it's a lot of times faith, a relationship with God. Again, a lot of people in real life struggle with that and think about it sometimes. And yet it's not really honestly dealt with in a lot of movies. It's either like they're the fanatic, or there's horror movies and it's always like
dark religion.
Yeah. It's like, it's like
Men in Cloaks.
There's cults or there's, exorcism and things like that, but it's not really like honestly dealt with very often. So that's
interesting.
That's my first question. Why is an actress more comfortable being a prostitute than a Christian in a movie?
I mean, all I can think of is PR, that there might be something public relations related here, and they're having to sort of address this but even that, I don't know. I'm
to Monster, for example. I mean, I'm not like, Charlize Theron isn't part of this conversation, but I'm just bringing up another kind of like about like a, you know, basically a horrible character essentially. That's cool. Basically. So I think that they kind of poke fun at this idea a little bit in the movie where Kathy Bates comes in and says, I'm a Democrat. And Tim McGraw is like, this is the first Democrat we've ever met. And I think that maybe it's sort of like similar kind of idea. Like, we know that this is kind of like a close knit. They talk about, you know, it's a redneck community. They know that they're, you know, super wealthy, super white, going to this private school. And that's all associated with Southern Christianity, I guess, also. So I think all that kind of culturally blends, you know, combines with other things that are not great, because it's that that culture is also associated with racism and other intolerance and things like that. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's all I wanted to say about it, but that was kind of, that, that surprised me as I was reading through the research here.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so early on.
Wikipedia counts as research, right?
You know, kind of.
Close enough.
It's halfway.
I mean, they're linked. They're linked to other articles.
So 30, maybe 45 minutes in,
yep.
I turned to my wife and I asked, is this titled The Blind Side or White Guilt, the movie? And I think that it does push all those buttons. You know, you have the swelling music cues that are meant, it's, this is all meant to make us feel very sort of good and absolved in a way. The family's very self-satisfied. Mm-hmm. And I want to read this quote here to get the conversation rolling on the topic of white guilt. Deborah Ross of The Spectator, she described the movie this way, quote, "This is the real story of Michael Orr, or at least it should be, but it actually isn't. It's the story of that rich white Christian family, the Tuohy?
Tuohys.
The Tuohys, who live in a swanky house in Memphis and take in Michael when no one else wants him. But I think the crux of her review is when she adds, quote, Michael doesn't really figure into all this. Michael is a big hulk, but he is also a big empty husk. His present inner life is anyone's guess, pretty much. His past life, meanwhile, is shown in brief flashbacks that peddle every black stereotype going. Michael is not a character, but a mirror in which the Tuohys can further admire themselves." So what is your reaction to that? Do you agree that the movie has an unbalanced focus on the white family? And if so, did that bother you, or is that just kind of the story that we're telling here and you rolled with it?
Well, I think that, I mean, the fact is, I mean, this is based on a true story. It's a little easier to get away with it in a way, because this is really what happened, that this white family took in this black teenager. But yeah, it does have this kind of white, you know, white savior complex kind of undertone to it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that it felt a little bit flat because of that, but there's a lot of other reasons that it was flat. And so that didn't seem like the most glaring issue to me.
I definitely would have liked to see more of his inner life and his experience, like she says.
Yeah.
Especially at the beginning, they kind of pick him up literally off the street. Mm-hmm. They bring him to this strange house where he sleeps on the couch. And
could you see that line coming from a mile away too? Oh, this is the first time you've had a room to yourself?
Yeah.
No. A bed.
It's worse than that. It's worse than you expected. Get ready.
And then you know exactly what her expression is going to be on her face.
Yeah.
She walks out. It's like that, but that's what you get Best Actress for?
I mean, we'll debate whether or not that the Best Actress thing is valid, I guess. But my point is, they bring him into this strange house, and she basically, the couch is yours, drops him some sheets, and then we follow her upstairs to talk to her husband about, so how long is this going to go on? What's the deal here? We never see him. She comes back downstairs. He's already gone. So
she's definitely the main character of the movie.
Yeah, but even just a couple of shots of him looking uncomfortable in this house, yeah, trying to figure out what their motivations are.
There is some of that.
What is he feeling?
But it's all pretty superficial. Like he has,
very.
I mean, his acting performance is not really that great in the movie.
No, he's a blank slate from pretty much beginning
to
end.
He has like this little sort of worried expression that he has a lot of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's supposed to show his emotion, but it feels pretty superficial.
And the things just keep happening to him rather than him doing anything, which isn't helping the situation,
yep,
because it makes him very, very passive.
Yep.
Elsewhere in Ross's review, by the way, she hated this movie, if you couldn't tell by those clips. She called it horrid, annoying, and creepy. Like she really laced into it. And I think that those adjectives go a little bit too far, at least for me, because whether I had this weird thing with movies like this, even if you could see certain manipulation happening. You can see the gears behind.
Yep.
And there's a fine line between me not wanting to be manipulated in that way if I don't feel like the payoffs are earned and I don't really hear. Mm-hmm. But also if they're kind of seamless enough, if the gears are hidden enough, if the movie is kind of benign and...
It's a slick Hollywood, you know, by the book,
yeah,
crafted movie,
mm-hmm,
with big star in at the center. The first, it's like one of the most successful movies ever with one female lead at the top.
Yeah.
And that's it, you know, and...
So it works as that kind of empty, sweet package, but as that thing, it does work.
Yeah.
So I give it credit, even if it's not for me in a certain way. And I just real, this was a really quick quote from Candace Frederick of Real Talk Online. She said, "I doubt I'd like the film as much had it not been Christmas and just a plain old good family flick to see with my mom." And part of me says, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not for me. It's not my thing. But I mean, Hallmark Channel exists for a reason, and it's because of movies like this. People watch it. It wouldn't exist if people didn't want this kind of product.
It accomplished what it was trying to do very well.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's not, none of the relationships are complex.
No.
There's, let me read a quote from A.O. Scott, New York Times. He said the movie was, quote, "made up almost entirely of turning points and yet curiously devoid of drama or suspense." Right on the money, A.O. Scott. There's really no drama.
No.
There is no hard decisions made by anybody in the whole movie.
No.
At the end, there's a little bit with, you know, is he under investigation?
That feels very made up.
It does.
That feels like, oh, we need a conflict at the end of this movie.
And you're like, is he buying that or is he not? Is he just going to stand up and defend them? And you think that it could very well be that he's just not falling for it. And then, you know, but it's like, we got to get this thing to 2 hours.
Yeah, here. We need some arguments. We need a falling out so that you guys can get back together.
A.O. Scott called it a, quote, "live action, reality-based version of a Disney cartoon."
Ouch. Yeah, I mean, he's not wrong.
I know.
He's not wrong.
But look, what did we, my complaint about Up is that symbolically the house didn't end up on its side at the end because it just randomly happened to be in the right place, you know, fall in the right place. Everything is supposed to be a happy ending in the end. It's happily ever after. It's Chocolat, you know, it's like all these, but again, these movies are there for a reason. A lot of people love them. It made $309 million.
I know.
That's a lot of money.
I think that there is definitely a part of us that wants to be manipulated and that wants things to be simple. Mm-hmm. We don't want to have to grapple with art all the time. Yep. We want to just look at a screen and say, oh, I feel better. You know, and on some nights,
inspiring,
your heart wins, and you're like, okay, fine. Yeah, I'll watch this. And you're not offended. It's fine. And then other nights, you're like Ross, who writes the words horrid and creepy and annoying. Although she also did say that SJ, the kid, was, quote, the most smackable movie kid I've seen in a long time. And I say that as someone who doesn't even believe in smacking children. So maybe I'm not so far off from her.
Ouch. So here's my question, you know, with this A.O. Scott quote, and then I have a couple other, you know, details afterward, but so if there's no drama, no suspense, mm-hmm, what was the biggest surprise in the movie to you?
Biggest surprise? That's a good question. Trying to think of when I didn't know when something was coming and then was surprised. Honestly, I can't think of one off the top of my head because you know when she picks him up and decides, you know that she's going to keep him long term. You know her husband's not going to have a problem with it. Yep. You know that he's going to end up staying. You know that he's going to be great at football. You know that the siblings are going to be fine with it. That he's going to raise his grades.
Yeah, like, oh, I don't know if he's going to be able to get an A on this last paper.
Yeah, well, no, he is.
There's no question he is.
And then you know that he's going to get a college scholarship. You know he's going to go to the college that they want him to go
You're
to.
You're saying he's going to get a college scholarship? Aren't we thinking a little bit ahead here? Oh, no. I'm going to make sure he gets that college scholarship. Are you sure, Sandra? Yeah, we know.
So I don't know. What am I missing? Is there a moment?
Here's the biggest surprise, and it was not a good surprise.
Okay.
That Michael Oher had zero clue about football. When he goes to that first practice, he's doing really dumb stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That if you've ever watched one football game in your life, which he has, sitting on the couch with all these football fans, big football family, right? Mm-hmm. He's watched football games, and yet he doesn't know anything about the game. He's like, I mean, at one point, even after this instruction, instead of blocking a guy, he throws him over his shoulder and runs after somebody with one hand. Like, no, I mean, you have to be trying.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
To be obstinately breaking every rule in football to do that. Mm-hmm. And he acts like, I don't know what to do. So like sometimes he's a total idiot and sometimes he's actually very smart and he makes like these insightful comments. The movie cannot decide whether he's dumb or smart. And it's not like in certain situations, like in some relationship moments, he's very insightful. And then other times, it's like he has no clue. Like he can't even understand what anybody's saying.
Yeah.
What is that?
He needs to be a blank slate enough for them to superimpose their values and everything onto him and for him to not struggle against this whole situation to begin with. But then he also needs to be smart enough to where it doesn't seem like we're talking down to him.
Yeah.
And I think that's the line the movie's kind of trying to ride with that inconsistency.
But then in the end, you know, he writes this amazing paper.
He writes a paper
based on, but he has like these nicely written lines, mm-hmm. and then they throw in a line like, that's pretty good to have, you know, like, I don't know. They're trying to have it both ways and it doesn't work. Michael Oher himself was not real happy with this movie. Mm. The real life guy, he wrote a book, I Beat the Odds: From Homelessness to the Blind Side and Beyond. And he wrote, I felt like the movie portrayed me as dumb instead of as a kid who never had consistent academic instruction and ended up thriving once he got it. Mm-hmm. He also apparently loved football from when he was younger and was actually tried hard to do it. So
he already had a talent before.
The movie made it sound like he was a blank slate with football. He wasn't a blank slate with football.
Like they built him up in every single aspect of his life.
And they gave it all to him. That's part of the white, you know, the white savior moment too. Like, we're going to teach you everything. You know, and I don't know, I guess the total lack of any drama with the family, like nobody in the family had a hard time with it. There's no character arcs whatsoever with the family. You know, we want you to be part of the family. And the daughter's like, yeah, thumbs up. The kid's like, yeah, please say yes to be in our family. And the dad's like, I got a surprise for you.
I guess. I don't really make any decisions except for I own, what, 50 Taco Bells or something?
Hundreds.
And also, isn't that that's a country music singer, the guy who's playing...
Tim McGraw, yeah. He's great.
What a weird casting choice. I mean, he's fine. I didn't really have any problems with him, but it's
You have to be...
Strange.
The casting description was, have to be willing to... get out of the way of Sandra Bullock at every moment.
Yep. And have a down-home charm.
Which he does. Peter Bradshaw of The Guardian said, quote, there is a rich, complex story to be told about Michael Oher and his mentor, Leanne Tui, but this waxwork parade isn't it.
Waxwork parade. I mean, that's great. that's some great word choice right there. All right, so you can't talk about this movie without talking about white guilt. You also can't talk about it without talking about Sandra Bullock. So let's get into the whole best actress winner thing. Mm-hmm. Not everyone loved her performance. Trevor Johnston of Time
Out. She won the three biggest awards.
I know. That's why I'm offering a contrasting opinion here, and we can you know, ping pong a little bit. Trevor says, quote, how Sandra Bullock deserved an Oscar for her one-note turn as bleached supermom Leanne is a mystery, since it transforms a potentially worthwhile character study into a grandstanding star vehicle. Her comic timing is just so, and she invests the homespun one-liners with a veneer of sincerity, but there's no way this is a real person. It's Sandra Bullock doing her thing. Where do you land? Is this a problem? Is he... Right? Does she redeem the movie? Is she only kind of a little bit better than it? What's your stance?
I think that I think best actress should be like, this is fine art. I don't think this movie is fine art. I don't think it was trying to be fine art. I don't think Sandra Bullock's performance is even trying to be fine art. I think it's trying to be kind of funny, charm, inspiring. You know, there's very little complex emotion in anything that she's doing. And so to me, that's not really, up for, shouldn't be even in the consideration. Is it good at what it does? Yeah, she's fun to watch. I mean, Sandra Bullock is fun.
Yep. So,
just like Julia Roberts. And, you know, I think that, but I think like, I was trying to compare this movie to like While You Were Sleeping. Have you seen that? It's been a while.
I haven't, no.
I mean, you haven't seen While You Were Sleeping?
No, you caught me with a with a no on that one.
Terrible. But in While You Were Sleeping, like there's moments where she's like legitimately, heartbreakingly weepy at having her heart broken. That, I think, is probably a more likely best actress kind of a movie than this, just because it's not the type of movie to even do it. So I have nothing to say against Sandra Bullock in it, because if I did, she would probably come over and beat me up.
She would.
You know?
She definitely would. He says, there's no way this is a real person. And I don't mind that it doesn't resemble a real person. I think that we see this all the time in cinema. Movie stars can get by on charisma alone, and we just accept that, oh, okay, their mannerisms are things I do not recognize in real life.
Yeah.
But that's okay, because I like watching this person.
Yep.
So that part of his review, I don't agree with. I do agree with a lot of the rest. I agree with what you're saying, that yes, she's good to watch. Do I think that it elevates to that level? Probably not. But she's kind of this ball of energy that bulldozes through the story. And where I think that she does deserve a lot of credit is that charisma that she has, that bulldozing effect, it keeps the focus on her, rather than on these gaps that we're sort of complaining about in the story. So rather than me watching this thing and just constantly rolling my eyes, I'm saying...
Which you didn't do at all.
No, I didn't have one eye roll. but you're kind of just having fun watching Sandra Bullock because she is a redeemer. Mm-hmm. So without her, this movie is much, much worse.
Yeah.
And I think that I would be much harder on it. So I kind of give her the extra credit for that.
So if it weren't for Sandra Bullock's performance, this would not make your top five. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I'm jumping ahead.
Yeah, it wouldn't make my top five for that reason and that reason alone.
Okay, so my third question and final question. Well, maybe not, but in our questions portion, does this movie prove that 10 is too many for Best Picture nominees?
Yeah. I definitely was thinking about this also with the Keep It or Kick It segment coming up, especially. It's just too much. It's
are there not 10 movies that are brilliant in 2009? Because there are. There's going
to
be movies.
There are always going to be 10 movies that I'm going to be able to take from a year and say, I want to remember these, and I would share these with people who like similar stuff as I do. But I think that's where it gets a little bit tricky with the Oscars, though, because you're picking 10 that you're hoping appeal to a wide audience on the mainstream, and you're almost kind of desperately like, okay, let's do weird stuff. Let's put in stuff like District 9, which I really like, but like, that's a good sci-fi action movie. Let's do that. And then let's get like this heartwarming one in there.
So
like
what
the Blind
the,
Side.
What are the quote unquote real top fives out of the 10?
It's still a little bit too early to go into that.
Not,
I think.
I'm not saying yours. I'm wondering like out of the Oscar top 10, we haven't really talked about the Oscar. We don't mention the Oscar.
Yeah,
every
we don't
time.
Do that every episode now.
So I'm gonna look up the 2010 real quick.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is that rather than this feeling like an exclusive club, it almost seems like we're trying to be inclusive by drawing in these other titles that wouldn't have made the cut before, just because now we have the room to do that. And I'm not one to give out participation trophies, Brian. You know this.
I know. I know.
You know this.
So the Best Picture nominees were Hurt Locker 1. I think pretty much most years that's going to be the type of movie that's in the top, that could be a top five.
Mm-hmm.
Avatar, which I think was a... We have 10 spots. That's going to work. Blindside, we have 10 spots. That's going to work. District 9, probably the same thing.
And let me just clarify on District 9.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to make my top five.
Yeah.
It might not.
I'm not holding you to it. I know.
But if it does, I still don't think that that would be justification for including it in the Academy's top five. It would just be kind of a personal favorite for me. But I don't think District 9 is a five I don't know.
Do you think this year is a weak year? So that's why, is that what you're saying?
I do. I think like that this
District,
year...
Like District 9 makes the top five, possibly. It's a borderline one for you, but in other years, it probably wouldn't be a borderline.
Yeah. If this was in 2007, there's almost no chance that it would be in my top five. But I do think that it's an enjoyable movie, but
yeah.
Should it be, you know, on the podium of the five of the year? Yeah.
And Education, it's been a while since I watched that.
Yeah, I haven't rewatched
Inglourious Bastards, is this the type of movie that is like a top five?
For me, yeah.
I know, but what about like an Academy five?
Yeah, I think so.
Precious?
Yeah, I haven't seen it since the first time.
It's been a long time. I'm very looking forward to rewatching that.
Yeah, yeah.
A Serious Man?
That's another one.
I can't tell. I haven't seen it yet.
I have to rewatch it.
I'm excited. Yeah. I have it on my shelf. Up? I mean,
we have 10 spots.
Again, Beauty and the Beast was in the top five.
Yeah.
Is Up as good as Beauty and the Beast? Better?
Wasn't, you know? Beauty and the Beast the... No, it wasn't. I don't know. I'm not sure.
And Up in the Air is the other one that was nominated. I guess I could see that one. I guess because Michael Clayton was nominated, I sort of think maybe it's just because it's another star vehicle for George Clooney. So here's something... Just to finish off my question about is 10 too many? The Blu-ray of The Blind Side was reissued as part of the best of Warner Brothers top 50 films made by Warner Brothers.
Okay.
Warner Brothers has a storied tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In 2013, it made the top 50 to be reissued.
Okay.
I didn't look at a list. I was thinking I should find a list of the movies that didn't make the list.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm guessing that the reason The Blind Side is in there is because it was a Best Picture nominee.
Yeah.
So it
just
shows. And
also part of the reason it made so much money, I'm sure, is because it was
actually
a nominee.
Actually, it made a ton of money in week one, week two, week three, week four. Like, it was a feel good. It worked. It wasn't even number one in the box office the first week because of Twilight movie.
And when did it release? Do you know the month?
I can't remember exactly. Okay. But it bounced up and down and it stayed in the top two or three for like a month or more.
Actually, I think it was Christmas.
It might have been.
Yeah,
because you're saying it was a Christmas movie.
Yeah, it was just at the very end of the year.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I do think the 10 is too much. I think that seeing this clarified for me that for the show, it's best to go with 5.
I don't think that 10 is too many. Because in 2008, I was ticked off at the 5. Because there were like 5 that I thought were legitimately in the top 10. What I think it does is, it was sort of like, it's an experiment and the Academy's like, let's be more expansive. We don't want the top movie to always be an obscure movie that no one has seen. Of course, then they got The Hurt Locker as the best picture, which didn't do very well in the box office. Not that many people had seen it by the time it won. But so it was like purposely shoehorning in these other movies that they thought were, it usually doesn't work, but made $300 million. Maybe that even has something to do with it. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Are we done with questions? Do you have another question?
Would you keep or kick this movie? I mean, I think that's where we are, and it's a mystery.
it's an easy kick for me.
So it being a kick, we can go back, excuse me, to our secondary, to our B questions here. If you're going to kick it, are you glad you saw it? Would you watch it again?
Mm-hmm.
These only really matter
if you're going to kick.
If you're going to kick.
And
they matter the most when we do the 5, because then I know there's been many times over the years where there's been a movie I've really, really liked, maybe even loved, okay, but it would be my number 6.
I'll say this.
But I'm kicking it.
Yes, I'm glad I watched it.
Okay.
I don't feel the need to watch it again.
As an artifact of film history, or because you got something personally
because
out of it?
Because I got something personally out of it. Here's what it was. It was a brave decision for the real life Leanne Toohey to take in a teenager and help that person get on, and what a great success story. That is inspiring. That's why they made a movie out of it. Haley, my wife, watched most of the movie with me, and afterward, it's like clockwork. If it was based on a true story, she's immediately looking up the articles that say, how it differed from real life and what, you know, what was the same. It's fascinating, right? Mm-hmm. So Michael Oher apparently got tons of fan mail saying that he inspired them to get out of their, you know, the projects basically. Hmm. And I would guess that the movie also inspired a lot of people to help out the homeless guy or the whatever. And so in that sense, I think this is a good thing for millions of people to have watched. So
that really reminds me of early on when we were talking about these, kind of inspirational movies or even movies that feel a little bit like homework historically, about feeling good at the end because we feel like we kind of participated in doing something good, even if we didn't. And I really wonder how much of what you're saying about people doing something after watching actually happened, or if you see those credits roll and you think, I'm going to do something good also. You know, how hard is it? I can donate. I could go. And then you just never do it because then you go to sleep.
But that moment where you think I could do that, that's still good for people. Whether you do it or not, it's better than never having that thought cross your head. It might happen later on. Hmm. Are you glad you watched it?
I could do without it.
You are.
No.
You are.
It's an easy kick. It's not going to be in my 10.
It's not even close to my 10.
It won't even be in my 10.
It's probably one of the worst Best Picture nominees that we have done a movie, an episode on.
Yeah. And that being said, I'm still not going to one star it. This falls in that,
I agree,
in that kind of Slumdog Millionaire, even Benjamin Button category in a way, where these are not
Benjamin
movies
Button
that I like
more than you did, but
very much. Mm-hmm. And at times they do annoy me, but they're just made with like a certain level of craft where the floor is just high enough to keep me from hating it. And so I'm like, okay, I see what you're doing, and you're not really, this movie is not made for me. It's made for maybe my mom, and that's fine.
Your mom needs movies, Mike.
She needs stuff to watch, but it's not going to be in my 10.
This is a
Am
mom.
I glad I saw it? I didn't see it 12 years ago when it released, and it was kind of for a reason.
This is a first watch.
Yeah, and I won't watch it again.
Were you surprised during the football game scenes where, you know, you get this one shot of him, of Michael, and he's looking up in the stands, and you get the eye lock, you know, from, it must have been 200 feet away, but they're both close-ups, so you're getting that emotion, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sandra gives him a little knowing nod, like, you can do this.
As soon as he figures out that he's supposed to be protecting his family, he suddenly has the best technique you could imagine as a lineman.
That's what I'm saying. It all comes full circle. She could do anything. She can coach any team. She can run any business because she's no nonsense.
You believe it. A couple trivia points. John Lee Hancock Jr. is the director. He also directed The Rookie in 2002. Directed Saving Mr. Banks, The Founder.
The Founder, I like.
I have not seen The Founder. I was kind of interested in that. He also wrote and directed in a horror movie called Mr. Harrigan's Phone from 2022. I don't even know if it's out yet, but it's based on a Stephen King story.
Hmm. Okay.
So I know talked about that one. Let's get the guy who did the horror movie early in his career, give him a $300 million budget.
Spider-Man, Sam Raimi.
So this guy goes
Rings.
From The Rookie and The Blind Side, and now we give him a horror budget. Now we give him a horror movie. What do you think? It's going to be a good horror movie?
Almost definitely going to hate it. It's going to be glossy and
You're
computer
terrible.
Generated.
You judge a movie by its director.
I mean,
what they have done.
100% watch it. And I'll keep an open mind.
He also made The Little Things, a 2021 neo-noir crime thriller. Has Denzel Washington and Rami Malek in it. Hmm. Kind of interesting. Also has Jared Leto. Sandra Bullock was the world's highest paid actress in 2010 and 2014. Her mother was an opera singer and her father was a part-time voice coach and he was in the army in Alabama. Her maternal grandfather was a German rocket scientist from Nuremberg. I mean, we're going full circle to the Nuremberg trials in The Reader. You know, that's a clear connection.
Yeah.
She lived in Nuremberg for 12 years, grew up speaking German.
Wow.
All right. So in the next episode, we're going to talk about Inglourious Basterds, the Quentin Tarantino movie about a band of Nazi killers and a Jewish survivor who inherits a movie theater.
Until then, find us wherever you listen to podcasts. We're also on social media, and for 16 years of golden takes, head over to letterboxd.com/Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show. Please.
Wherever you get your podcasts. And even where you don't.
I already said that.
Even where you don't get your podcasts. Still
just subscribe everywhere.
Yes.
Just go around the internet and find subscription buttons.
Thank you.
Just click them.
For listening to Best Picture This, the waxwork parade of film criticism.